Hello, my name is Sam Clements, and welcome to the Love of Cinema, a Picture House podcast. We've made it to October, guys, which is very exciting for a number of reasons. Not only is it getting a little bit wintry outside, I do like a chill in the air. I like being able to get the big coat out. And more importantly, especially to this podcast, the big films are out. We've got some incredible films coming out in October, coming to your local Picture House cinema, one of which you've probably read about in the press, No Time to Die, already in cinemas before the pod is out. It beat us to it. So for our October bumper edition of The Love of Cinema, we are joined by two fantastic film critics in Clarice Lockery and Hannah Flint, the co-hosts of the Fade to Black podcast and two fantastic film writers in their own right. I love reading their work, and I follow both of them on Twitter. They post all their articles on there and just generally a good follow if you like some film chat, would recommend that. But their podcast is superb. And actually, if you are a fan of the Mark Kermode and Simon Mayo podcast, the Wittertainment Show, you may have heard Clarice on there being the super sub, or one of the many super subs for Mark Kermode when he goes away on his annual summer cruise. I'd love to pass you over to Hannah and Clarice to talk about our first film, which is the latest James Bond outing, reportedly the last Daniel Craig outing as 007. He's hanging up the tuxedo once and for all. But it's No Time to Die. It's in cinemas right now. It's directed by Cary Joji Fukunaga. And if you enjoy the film, or you're generally intrigued by the film, do check back on this pod feed, because I actually spoke to Cary, who I learned is a loyal Picture House customer. He visits Picture House Central and did so quite a lot during the shooting of No Time to Die. So here we are, Hannah and Clarice, talking about No Time to Die.
Why would I betray you?
We all have our secrets. We just didn't get to yours yet.
So, Clarice, what did you think of No Time to Die? Did you die?
I didn't die. I'm still alive here today. I mean, I think it's interesting that we're both talking about Bond, because I don't know if we're both the biggest fans of the franchise. I've always been a little bit of a pick and choose type of person when it comes to Bond. I love GoldenEye because that was part of my childhood. I'm utterly obsessed with Casino Royale. And so I wasn't coming into No Time to Die with sort of the weight of fandom on my shoulders. I just wanted to see a great action movie. And I will say, I think Cary Fukunaga delivered wholeheartedly on that side. It looks fantastic. The action sequences, like, were some of the best I think I've ever seen in a Bond film. But in terms of the Bond storyline, it's hard. It feels like, I know this is Daniel Craig's last film, they're trying to do a lot of work to tie up all the loose threads. And it got very, like, you know, six films into the Marvel Cinematic Universe vibes. Like, we have too many characters. Yes, Endgame vibes. Yes, very much.
I feel like it's my civic duty as a British-born citizen with a passport that I must watch every single Bond movie. You know, that's just the cross I bear. And, you know, I don't mind it, especially as they're not, like, when you think about it, they're quite infrequent. We're not getting, you know, Bond movies every single year. And so, you know, that a lot of time had passed with this one. So I was kind of like, do I care? Do I care that Daniel Craig's back and all the women who were starring opposite him are like 20 years younger? Am I into that? I think Cary Fukunaga is basically my kind of main interest in this, because I really enjoyed Maniac, the TV series. And also, he's just really fit. So I really fancy him. So that's my first came out. I think you're absolutely right. The action in this is amazing. And just the detail within delivery. And there are moments where I sat and just like, oh, like, oh my God. And like saying to my friend, like, yo, that was wild. But also just the delivery, the way that Daniel Craig, the kind of swagger, the kind of, oh, I just do this every day. I'm Bond. I can do what? Jump on a motorbike. Yeah, jump off. Yeah. All these type of things. It just felt, I liked the ease with which he kind of moved through the world. And I thought, oh, this is what we like about Bond. We like the fact that, yeah, he's a normal guy, but he's also highly trained and highly efficient. And I think that's what Daniel Craig brought to this version of Bond in that he looked the part. Compared to like Pierce Brosnan or Sean Connery, sure, they look great, but they're all quite skinny, not really muscle. Like, you kind of don't believe that they could, you know, do all the feats, especially as increasingly outlandish as they become. But I think the problem with this, like you said, it's very much like a paint by numbers. It was trying to, you know, it did everything you'd expect and you've seen before from a 007 Bond film.
Yeah, it's interesting that you're kind of talking about Cary Fukunaga and Daniel Craig as being linked kind of on the same level, because that's how I really felt about it. Like, the best thing about No Time to Die is that they both match each other. Both in, I guess, the energy and the sort of like radical nature that they bring to Bond. I love that Daniel Craig's performance has always been like, I'm going to play James Bond like he is a granite slab that emotions are trying to punch their way through. And then sometimes it makes it through to the other side. And that's when you really see like the broken James. And I think that's such an incredible way to perform that character. I honestly don't really know how it's going to be topped with the next one. And then what I loved about the direction is matching that energy by, like, you say that, yeah, about being shocked by some bits. It's oddly scary. I was surprised by how scary No Time to Die is. There's a hauntingness to it. There are scenes where he's like going into the misclogged forests, or he goes to a spectre party and it's like very bacchanalian. I wrote in my review that it's sort of like the Bond version of Dante's Inferno. He's like going through the layers of hell. And that's such a weird way to approach Bond, but I kind of loved it.
That, it kind of sense of gravitas. That's what I mean, the flourishes. It kind of captures in so many, I suppose, nuanced ways and barely perceptible ways. But I think probably one of the weakest links is Rami Malek, who's, I just didn't really understand the point of his Bond. Like, I didn't get what his purpose was. Like, I didn't understand why, you know, obviously they've all got a kind of plot of like final, you know, domination, devastation. And I didn't really get that. And it kind of came across as though, like, I can imagine his character appearing. If he just like pushed it a bit more, it could be in the parody Bond with Will Ferrell playing the spy. Like, that's what I saw it as. It was beyond parody. Yeah, I just didn't think that really worked.
Yeah, it felt like it's kind of spinning the wheel of Bond villains and just, you know, going, oh, he's, you know, he's got facial scarring, boom, he's got an accent, boom. And I think the worst parts of this movie are the spinning the wheel and just poking things and going, sure.
Yeah. I do love the fact that good. Rami Malek is like, I'm not going to play a stereotypical Arab stereotype. I don't want to perpetuate that, but I will play an Eastern European terrorist stereotype. Like, that's, it's like, oh, it's okay for me to stereotype one foreigner, but not the foreigner that I'm concerned with.
Well, there we go. I always find it interesting in the UK when people talk about James Bond, because everybody knows that character in that film series. Everybody has an opinion. And I always love hearing people's relationship to the series. People often offer some sort of qualification to it as well, like, oh, I watched them all when I was growing up, or I used to go with my parents, or oh, I've never seen one before, or oh, they're all the same and they're a bit rubbish, aren't they? Or I, you know, they're all amazing and I loved them all. Like, everybody's got some sort of opinion there. So it's really nice to now know Hannah and Clarissa's relationship to James Bond. And I fully agree with what they were saying. I think the only thing to add really is this is the best looking James Bond I have seen. And I am qualified to say that because during one of the lockdowns, I bought the Blu-ray box set. I was really struggling to decide what to watch. What series has a lot of films in it? And I was steered towards the James Bond series, and I hadn't really seen all of them. And if I had, I must have been quite small when I saw some of the films in the franchise. So I bought the box set. I did all of them in January. I had a really fantastic time, even when the films weren't so great. I still had a fantastic time watching them because it was a bit of a research project. And I really like what Daniel Craig's done with the character. Casino Royale was my favorite in the franchise. That may change with a couple more watches of No Time to Die. I'm going to go back. I've seen it once. I'm going to go back. I'm going to see it again. and we'll see where it ends up. But it's a fantastic film. It looks so good. The cinematography is mind-blowing. The production design is really top tier. It's the best looking of the Craigs, and it might be the best looking of all of them, that's for sure. Anyway, that's enough on No Time to Die. Hopefully you've gone to the cinema to see it, and if you haven't, there's still plenty of chances to catch that one on the big screen, as it should be seen. Up next, now for something completely different, Hannah and Clarice are going to review a film that has been getting amazing reviews on the film festival circuit, and it finally comes to cinemas on the 15th of October. It's Never Gonna Snow Again. It's directed by Małgorzata Zamoyska and Mikhail Englert, and there are collaborators, long-term collaborators. So what you're about to hear is Hannah and Clarice reviewing Never Gonna Snow Again, and then stick around after that because Clarice actually jumped on Zoom with Małgorzata to talk about making Never Gonna Snow Again. It was a really fantastic chat. It was so great to hear her talk about the film.
Женя, заходи.
Где мы съемы?
So, Hannah, you saw this movie before me, and you gave me one comparison to go into the film with, and it didn't make sense to me at the time when you told it to me, but now having seen it, it does, and I wondered whether you wanted to elaborate on that first.
Happily do so. Yeah, I said... It reminded me of Edward Scissorhands because it's about kind of an outsider who goes into this, I mean, it's a gated community, and he provides a sort of like, I suppose it's a beauty kind of service, and it kind of changes, you know, people's lives around, and it creates this kind of cult following, and it gets quite dark. But I mean, that's very loosely. I feel like there's, you know, that's just the basic thing, but it did really remind me of that and how much of, I don't know, I think what's good about Edward Scissorhands is how much his character held up a mirror to the people around him. And I think that's what happens in this with Xenia, who, you know, he comes in and he's real, and I thought it was really interesting, you know, especially when you think about like how wellness, you know, just on the high sense, like wellness is, you know, getting people to be in touch with themselves and get rid of their bodies. And a lot of things when it comes to mental health and psychology, our body is affected by that. And I thought it was interesting that he would come in and have this sort of, I don't know, like wellness power over people. I suppose make them confront a lot of the things, but then also relying on that person, even though they have passed their own prejudices, that would actually, if this person didn't provide you something, you'd happily just cast them aside. So I thought it was really interesting, the kind of class conversations, the kind of, but fed in with this magical realism element. And also just, I don't know, it's just really melancholy. And also snow, because I know Never Gonna Snow Again, there's a snowing thing, but there's a whole running thing about it.
Yeah, I was interested in that comparison because having watched it, it really brought out, in terms of the director, Małgorzata Zamoyska, like, in comparison to her earlier work, I think this is like starting to go more into the surreal, magical side. And also the social satire is really coming out. I think she's always kind of made films about outsiders and communities and that idea. But I think, yeah, I don't know, the Edward Scissorhands comparison makes sense sort of looking at this film and what she's made in the past. And what's so interesting to me about it is the sort of social satire political aspect of it, that it is a film about Poland. And I think as British audiences, yeah, we're definitely gonna get some of what's happening and some of the nuances of it, but you really have to watch it in the context of capitalism as an idea is sort of still fairly new, or as like a functioning system is still fairly new in Poland. It's like 30 years old. And I think a lot of Polish people, like there's a general vibe of, well, I know this is what the director's talked about, is there is this sort of excitement about it and this like very rapid acquiring of wealth, and people are really clinging on to their status and to their money and to what it means to them. And so I think the image of the gated community, like, it has so much more of this added significance, you know, to what we may be watching as, yeah, as like a British audience where, you know, capitalism has been around for a while.
Yeah.
Pretty used to it, but now.
Damn you, construct, superstructures. I think, you know what's interesting? I wasn't actually aware of her past work, so I'm coming from this fresh eyes, but I suppose what you were saying there about what's interesting is that the main character, he's an immigrant, like, you know, and he kind of, you know, at the beginning kind of costs, like, I don't know, uses his powers, if there's powers, or it's just like, you know, hypnotism, whatever, like, to gain entry to get a work permit. And I think what's interesting is how, like, in the UK, the xenophobia towards Eastern European immigrants coming over, and I suppose I've kind of been very hyper aware of how, like, Polish immigrants are seen as, like, you know, kind of given a pejorative, have a pejorative status in here in the UK. So what's so interesting is to see that film in Poland and, like, how actually it doesn't matter what country that you're in, basically xenophobia and discrimination and fear of the other is prevalent everywhere. But it was really interesting how in that one where it's like, actually, you know, I think one of the characters says, like, she doesn't like Ukrainian immigrants, and he's supposed to be Russian because he's, you know, and it's like interesting, like, how no matter how it becomes even a film that kind of transcends, it doesn't really, even though it's a Polish story, it actually could play out pretty much anywhere in the world because these themes are pretty universal. And I think in a way that's how I was able to connect to it, that maybe there were probably nuances, like you've mentioned, that were very specific to Polish, you know, viewers or audience members or even from that part of the world. But I definitely felt like I connected with that. And also, I just really quite liked, yeah, like, the way the surrealist, I always kind of like a surrealist element. I love, you know, I love how much, like, dance is in it and music and, you know, even, like, a kind of final act performance that just feels so, I don't know, kind of, yeah, whimsical. There's, like, as much as this is quite a, like, a melancholic tale, it's quite whimsical as well. And it kind of, and then that balance kind of stopped it feeling a bit, I don't know, too down or too subdued. And I really kind of relished that in this film.
And the magical quality of him is so interesting to me because, yeah, there is this feeling of, you know, is what does he represent to these people? And I think to some degree it's the past because, you know, if we're going back to this idea of, like, Poland and capitalism and sort of, like, new history, I think part of that has always been about denying the past. And, you know, a big part of his background is that he comes from Pripyat, which is near Chernobyl, and, you know, that is, like, he's sort of like history in the flesh, like, trying to come remind these people of the past, and to see the way that they handle it, like, some of them are absolutely fascinated. Well, a lot of them, they're mostly just, like, fascinated by him. They find him very exotic, but they're also, like, trying to sort of keep him at a distance. Like, there's such a weird relationship between him and all the people in this gated community. So yeah, I think, yeah, that's the thing about this film. It's fascinating and magical just to watch the way that, you know, we're going from reality into dreams and how those things are, those lines are being blurred. But I think having the kind of context of what this says about Poland, just, like, it adds this whole other level to it. I wondered, when you're working in collaboration with someone for such a long period of time, do you both change together artistically in a very organic way? Or are these the kinds of things that you have to sit down and talk about, maybe even negotiate and just figure out individually first what you want out of your work?
Actually, it's a very interesting question, I would say. I kind of agree with the sentence you said, that it's very organic, actually. I mean, we've been working together more than 20 years right now. We have been started, I think we've been like 22, 23 years old at film school in Lodz, doing our short films together, which been very successful, premiered at Cannes Film Festival, etc. And for such a young people, it was very interesting that we found each other, like, feeling exactly the same way. And our perception of reality was, like, almost similar with not too many words. So really, Until now, we are not talking a lot. I mean, this is so much based on intuition, on instinct, especially if we are talking about our films. Sometimes we have some differences when we are talking about some other people work. I mean, he likes something, I don't, and opposite. But when we are thinking about our films, it's like we don't need to talk too much. We don't have to use too many words, because I think most of the time we feel the same. We are on the same page. I think to explain that we are like grew up in very similar families, because Michał Englert, he's from very established artistic family. Like his mom, she's a very established theater and film actress. Father, he's a theater director. Uncle, he's a director and actor. And my parents, who actually died more than 16 years ago, they've been also like a documentary director, journalist, writer, etc. So it was sort of intellectual families from communism period. From communist period in Poland, that kind of families they actually don't exist anymore, which is kind of pity. But so we got the same background. We've been reading the same books like Dostoevsky, Thomas Mann, Hermann Hesse. We've been watching the same films like Andrei Tarkovsky, Ingmar Bergman, Fellini, Bertolucci, like everything. Like we had the access to this very super high profile classical art. So we grew up on that. So but maybe because of that link, we are very similar and we are developing in the same direction.
That's so interesting. And I know this is the first time that he's been credited as co-director, when in the past he's been mostly credited as a cinematographer or writing producing partner. What moved you to make that decision for this film?
I can tell you it's very, very often in Polish, I would say Polish film school, because we are from Lodz, Polish film school in Lodz, where Roman Polański, Andrzej Wajda, Krzysztof Kieślowski, Wojciech Jerzy Haas, they teach there. They've been also pupils like we at that very famous school. And so this school is also super famous on having a very special DOP department. Those DOPs, they are taught by the professors to be very creative on the directing side. So they are doing by themselves short films as a directors during the school. They know how to work with actors. They know how to tell the stories, and that's from they are famous, you know. And especially in our case, we start to work together on the scripts, writing together, developing the idea from zero. So I said to myself that, especially on that film, which is super visual, I think it's going to be like very okay and loyal to me, to Misha, to honor him with that credit, and also open and maybe a new chapter in our collaboration for the future. So we can be authors, co-directors together on the pieces, which are very author pieces written by us, maybe with someone else's help, but like our author pieces. Because of course, there is also another activity in my directing, which is like I'm doing sometimes films also with Michał as a cinematographer, for based on the other people's scripts in English language. So this is a kind of different activity. I would say I treat it more as a job, you know what I mean? Like interesting, like developing my skills, etc. But if we are talking about my outdoor cinema, which is Never Gonna Snow Again, it's the perfect example. I have a strong feeling that this is not only my film, this is our film. And for the future, we are planning to develop another film as a duet. But of course, in the meantime, probably it's going to be something here and there, doing some other stuff, not based on our scripts. So this is a kind of different different activity, different example. But what is very funny, I must say, that on Polish Film Festival in Gdynia, which ends up a week ago, is the most important Polish national film festival. So it has nothing to do with an international audience. The film which won the big prize, it's also, I was kind of surprised because I was an artistic supervisor on that film. And I was surprised because also cinematographer, he's attached as a co-director finally. So, I mean, we show probably a kind of way, you know what I mean? So we open in Poland, definitely, we open a kind of new door, you know, for that collaboration being written as a credit on the screen.
Well, I want to delve straight into the themes of the film now, because I think the more that I read about the Polish perspective on this film, I think it is very different maybe from what people in the UK would superficially get out of it. And I'm thinking specifically of the significance, the setting of the gated community, which I know, you know, means something very specific in Poland.
Yes, I think it's very specific, because I cannot see anything like that in UK or in France or in Spain. I mean, it's so typical for Poland, for US, I would say, and probably for, you know, like, I guess something like this happening in Ukraine, maybe, I mean, all, or maybe somewhere in Russia, it might be popular. I think that's the post-communistic idea, kind of, because, you know, people, they've been struggling with poverty, and like, we didn't know anything about capitalism. So when finally in 89, the communism fall apart, people was super hungry of being wealthy, you know, and having an access to goods, which we didn't have before. So people starts to work like crazy, starts to use capitalism in the wild way. Plus in 90s, it was kind of easy to become very fast, super rich. Why? Because it was like no rules, you know, it was kind of wild capitalism at the beginning, I would say. So many, many, many people, they became rich or more wealthy than the others. And those people, they decide that they want to gate themselves. They want to separate themselves from the people who don't have an access to that kind of reality. And this reality is like, we don't have such a big class differences like in UK yet. We don't have like in France, but still this is a kind of abstract thing for many people, that the people that are living in the gated community and the kids, they are going to the private schools. I mean, it's I would call it like new rich, but also new Polish middle class, upper middle class. They don't want to be poor, you know. And now I can see that gap between classes like you have in UK is growing, you know? And this is also a sign of that. So I'm afraid like in 10, 15 years, it's going to be worse and worse, because those people just want to take care about themselves as a wealthy society, being separated from the rest of society, having access to something because of money.
I just hope everyone listening today just goes to see Never Go to Snow Again, because it is masterful. And thank you so much again for joining me today.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It was super nice.
Well, thank you, Clarice, for doing the interview. And a big thank you to Małgorzata for joining us on the podcast. The film is in cinemas on the 15th of October. And I do recommend going to the cinema for this one. It's really good with an audience. I saw it at the London Film Festival about a year ago now. And yeah, it's a hoot with a crowd. So do seek that one out. Coming up now, again, something completely different. One of the biggest films of the year. Will it be bigger than Bond? That's for the newspapers to hypothesize about. But I definitely think it could hold its own in an arm wrestle with No Time to Die. We're going to review Denis Villeneuve's Dune, There's been a lot of hype for this. Again, it was one of the sort of famous films that got moved back about a year during the pandemic, but it's coming to cinemas. And what I've read about it sounds like this is absolutely one to see at the cinema. It's got huge scale and spectacle in and a million miles away from David Lynch's take on Frank Herbert's famous novel Dune. I've got a soft spot for the David Lynch Dune, but this one looks like it's totally elevated the quality of the filmmaking to a whole new level. So I'm very jealous to hear that Hannah and Clarice got to see the film before me. Also that Clarice has seen this film three times already, and it's not even out yet. But I couldn't think of anybody more qualified to talk about this film. So here we go. Clarice, Hannah, talking Dune.
Rolling over the sands, you can see spice in the air. The outsiders ravage our lands in front of our eyes.
Clarice, you've seen this movie three times now, and we saw it together. You saw it when I saw it for the first time, you saw it for the third time. So, you know, three films in, 6 hours in, or seven, wait a second, 9 hours. Is Dune every bit the masterpiece you said in your original review?
I'm so embarrassed. I feel very called out by this. Look, I've realized I'm a big fan of this sort of like fantasy / sci-fi genre like this, and Star Wars apparently are just my absolute jam. And I was completely new to Dune when I watched it. I had not read the book. I hadn't even seen the David Lynch film, which I don't even know how that happened. So going in with a completely fresh set of eyes, like, this was an absolute revelation to me. And I've just decided to become a Dune person. I am just a Dune person now. That's me.
Show me your tattoo.
I'd love to get one. I mean, I feel like I also want to, we should introduce your relationship to Dune, because you have a very different relationship to Dune than I do, because it was not new for you.
I think I read it for the first time, though, like about six years ago. And one thing I really connected to was how much, from what was so clear, was how much Frank Herbert, I mean, look, the reason why they say this is one of the hardest films to the books to adapt, because it's so dense. Like, the minutiae of detail that is in the politics, the philosophy, the theology, the ecology that he's built into this universe. I mean, there's so much there. But for me, what really stood out as someone who is of Middle East and North African heritage was how much of that influence came from Arab Islamic history, especially in North Africa, you know. Then, so I was kind of really looking forward, oh my God, like the Fremen, they're so clearly Middle East and North African, Bedouin inspired. This is going to be great. We're going to get like finally in a big blockbuster movie, we're going to have like Chani played by someone who's like Middle Eastern or Stilgar. Like, that's going to be sorted. So when I first came around to the casting, obviously when I saw that Javier Bardem and Zendaya were cast, and I saw, and obviously as it got on, it was quite disappointing for me, because it felt like basically so much of this book is influenced by these things, but we're not seeing that representation on when it's translated to the screen. So me going into it, not only did I have, I suppose, the backstory knowledge of the book, so I had my own impression of what this looks like, but I also had this slight bittersweet, I suppose, taint. There's a slight taint going into it, knowing that I'm not actually going to see. And I was trying to see, like, okay, but there might be other characters who might reflect, or we might feel like it's, you know, whatever. Or it might be so good a film that I'm like, you know what, fine, it's great. But, you know, that'll be my only issue. Taking away conversation of what we could talk about briefly about the representation in it, if we took that out of the equation, I still wasn't blown away by Dune, but in the sense of the storytelling, but in the world building, it's magnificent. It's just, I'm just in awe of some of the stuff that they managed to visualize and create.
I think, you know, as someone who was a Dune newbie, like, as much as I absolutely adored this, yeah, seeing Javier Bardem as Stilgar, you know, where he's sort of, he's dressed to look Middle Eastern, but you know, he is Javier Bardem just being his Spanish self, which it felt odd to me. I think that's the thing with me and my sort of like no context approach to it, because everything else about this movie is so careful and so considered and so beautifully put together. And the production design references, the costume design references, the way that it's looking at both not only a global perspective on culture, but like an archaeological perspective on culture. Like a lot of the reference points are like older things like 17th century Flemish woodwork and Byzantine robes or Russian Orthodox robes. Like it's such a gorgeous, gorgeous film. And, you know, we all know Denis Villeneuve's style of filmmaking, like the scale of it is just, I love a film that makes me feel very small, felt very small and insignificant watching this. And it's something you really feel, it's a movie that you really feel in your bones. And I think that's what's drawn me back to want to watch it again and again. It's the plot side of it and the storytelling, I think. There's enough in there for me that I didn't feel confused. I kind of understood what was going on. I could grasp the themes because now I've gone back and I've started reading the book. I've read much more about Dune's history and its significance. And I go, oh, yes, I see. I see how this is all in the film. It's been put in there. It's layered. But I think the biggest takeaway from it is really the sensory experience of it, of like, oh, I am in Arrakis. Like, I feel like I'm there right now.
Yeah, I think it felt like it was living. I would say like Hans Zimmer's score felt like as much of a living character as any of the people you were seeing on screen. You know, the fact that you had this, the murmuring of drums that kind of functioned like a heartbeat, and then even like using, you know, the voice, so layered, multi-layering the voice, which, you know, is for some people that's considered, you know, God's perfect creation, like God's instrument. And I think that's such an interesting use, and it also evokes even more religious symbolism in a film that's very much steeped in kind of the idea of how religion is used to hold power, oppress people. Dune is all about cyclical natures of dynasties and civilizations and how we kind of repeat ourselves all the time. And pretty much I'm kind of an anti-messiah message, I think, ultimately he's trying to say. And I think in a way that informed, the music definitely informed it, although I did find it oppressive at times. I found that I couldn't really hear the dialogue, and sometimes I don't think it worked against it. I think sometimes, you know, there's really great moments of stillness, of kind of silence. There's a great scene where the Sardaukar arrive in this location and Fremen have just been there, and you're just kind of waiting for something to happen. And then, you know, suddenly come up, and that those fight sequences are great. It's really good execution of that. This, again, the complexity of these stories and the backstory, I think there was something missing there. I also found it to be quite subdued. It didn't push the story off. I mean, obviously split up this book. This is part one. We're going to get part two. I felt like there wasn't established enough. I think there's far more depth that could have been injected had they kind of cut certain bits at the beginning. I get they're trying to contextualize it. But yeah, ultimately, I think it's a visual feast, but I'm not desperate to see part two, especially if, you know, how the Fremen and the representation for Middle East and North African people is going to be limited to this, and we're not actually going to have that. It just feels like, you know, Denis Villeneuve, you know, he, as you said, he made such an effort to realize this film, and you can see it in so many ways, but it feels like, you know, some of the key bits have been lost in translation, and I kind of feel like he's corrupted the story on translating it to the screen by not officially having it, by basically erasing Middle Eastern people and Arab people and Islamic influence from it.
I am so excited to see Dune. I've booked my tickets. I will be there opening day, which is the 21st of October. Opening on a Thursday, one of those films opens on a Thursday and really confuses me because I am so used to films opening on a Friday, but Dune is a Thursday opener and tickets are actually on sale right now. Now, if you like Timothée Chalamet, who is the star of Dune, or one of the many stars of Dune, he also stars in this next film, which is Wes Anderson's The French Dispatch. At Picture House, we love Wes Anderson. We've done seasons of all of his movies in the past, and we've done, for his last film, Isle of Dogs, we did a special dog-friendly screening that Wes Anderson introduced for us. And because that screening was such a big hit, with people bringing their dogs into the cinema to watch a film, we've carried on doing dog-friendly cinema. So Wes Anderson, in a way, is responsible for dog-friendly cinema. And yes, we will be doing dog-friendly shows of The French Dispatch. So if you want to bring your pooch to the movies, go check out your listings. I think we'll be doing these on the opening weekend of the film. So the final weekend of October, there will be chances to bring your dog to the cinema to watch a Wes Anderson film together, which sounds really charming and delightful. And I wish I had a dog. Sadly not, but I can go and watch Wes Anderson's latest film, which I am so hyped for. Big, big, big Wes Anderson fan. And, you know, it just keeps getting bigger and better. This one looks like it's got Grand Budapest Hotel vibes, which is one of my favourites of his in recent years. The ensemble cast, as always, is mind-blowing. That's really all I can say on the film. So let's pass over to Clarice and Hannah.
We take as the subject of tonight's lecture Mr. Moses Rosenthal, certainly the loudest artistic voice of his rowdy generation.
Simone Naked Cell Block J Hobby Room. I want to buy it.
It's not for sale.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't.
Yes.
In short, the picture was a sensation.
Like, I'm such a sucker for Wes Anderson. So I feel like I was very sold. I was immediately already sold, pre-sold on The French Dispatch. Also because I'm French-American, it's about Americans in France. This was sort of the movie for me. So I feel like I want to hear your opinion first, because mine is just going to be so tainted by all of this other stuff going on with me.
Look, I actually really, I love anything that's about journalism. I have this kind of, you know, obviously professional interest in, and I like, there are things in this movie where it made me chuckle because they are specifics about the experience of being a writer or journalist. Also kind of made me despair of like how much they got paid to write stories and stuff compared to what the situation is now. That was quite disturbing. That was a kind of horrible reminder of how bad it is. But, you know, there is one thing about Wes, and I really enjoy, is, you know, apart from, you know, his obvious lack of, I mean, putting the lack of people of colour in his films aside, I do really enjoy the worlds that he builds. And I think this world, it's just so meticulously beautiful and just continental and just textures and nostalgic. And I adored it. I adored the way it looked. I always enjoy the way that Wes, he obviously directs the camera. It's like, he's like, this is what you're going to look. But this is what you want to focus on. And there's so many ways I feel like the practical sets that inform this and allow this kind of multi-storied action. I love the different levels that we were going to. And it brought us up and down and in and out and, you know, turns. I really love that kind of visual choreography, the visual dance of what he's doing. Love the costumes. We love costumes. Costumes are great. And, you know, even the kind of, I suppose, the structure of this, I like the conceit. I like the idea that it's this magazine and we're going to see little vignette-y stories. You know, I'm not really a New Yorker reader, but I've read enough and know enough by osmosis to kind of understand the references and see, you know, how much he loves that magazine, how much he loves print magazine journalism. And it was very funny at moments, but it felt a bit frothy. Like in the same way that I feel his past films have always had, I suppose, a through line of kind of understanding, like, you know, whether it's families. I mean, family comes up a lot, but I feel like this, it kind of was like, you know what? We're not going to bore you with that detail. We're just going to throw these three stories at you and you're just going to like luxuriate in it. And that's about it. We don't expect anything more of you. Please don't expect anything more of me.
Yeah, I would categorize this, you know, within the Wes Anderson oeuvre as being kind of more twinned with the Darjeeling Limited. It's sort of a travelogue film, and it's really about, and this is what really got me on a sort of base emotional level, is that it's about France through the American perspective and this very like romanticized vision of France. And there's so many specific touches, like there's a scene of the morning in Blasé sur Ennui, where it's the shutters opening and then someone with a baguette pops out. There's a little terrier running across the street. And you know, for me as someone who's French, but I've never lived there, I have very romanticized visions of France as well. And like, that's what it is. That's what France is the little terrier running across the street on an early Sunday morning. And, you know, that what you said about the detail work, it's so loving. It's like he clearly, as you said, has such an affection for this place, for journalism, for the New Yorker, for the journalists that he's honoring through this movie. I think that's both the sort of the greatest advantage and the disadvantage of The French Dispatch, is that it's so focused on the detail. I think, as you said, when you step back, it's not as effective as something like The Grand Budapest Hotel or The Royal Tenenbaums, which those two movies, I think, because we got to follow the same characters throughout the entire film, like their journeys has so much more of an emotional punch to them. Because what I really like about his films is this very like romantic framing of tragedy in a way that I think it always feels nuanced to me. It doesn't feel like weird or exploitative. He can talk about very sad people being sad in a way that doesn't diminish the honesty of those feelings and the truth of those feelings, but still you get to kind of like see it through this stylized aesthetic framework. And I think, you know, I felt that so much with Ralph Fiennes' character in The Grand Budapest Hotel, so much with all the characters of The Royal Tenenbaums. Here we're spending little snippets of time with people, and like you get a little bit of a sense of their histories and of their pain and what they suffered through, but it's just not quite the same. It's not quite the same.
I think the closest we got that was with Jeffrey Wright's James Baldwin-esque character. That's about as deep as this wanted to go, which is great. But also, I suppose my criticism of it, and this is my issue again with the representation of journalists on screen, is how often women, female journalists, kind of either have like some sort of unethical, sordid line of it. And both Tilda Swinton and Frances McDormand's characters have that sort of like the slutty journalist. I mean, not slutty, but kind of like, hey, we're going to sleep with our subjects type of attitude. But I'm not going to like discount the whole film. It's not the worst offenders in the kind of grand history of those. But I also appreciate that Owen Wilson got to get on a bike again since Eugene and Dupree.
That sounds like a feast, a cinema feast. I've been watching the trailer for this because, again, this was one of the films that got pushed back to October. I've been watching the trailer for this so much. I love that during the three different stories that Hannah and Cruz mentioned, the film stock changes, the aspect ratio changes. I used to be a projectionist in a past life, so I love talking aspect ratios. And Wes Anderson always delivers on changing the sort of window, the size of the picture on screen. Okay, we should think about wrapping this podcast up because we need to go to the cinema and see some films. There's a lot on, and I don't want to miss them on the big screen. Just with The French Dispatch, that film opens on the 22nd of October. So if you like Timothée Chalamet, who stars in both of those films will be in cinemas at the same time. If you want to get ahead of the game, if you want an early dose of Timothée Chalamet, you can go on the 21st of October, and then The French Dispatch opens on the 22nd. Now, it'd be rude to invite Hannah and Clarice on and not ask them what they're looking forward to watching at the cinema in the future. Here's what Hannah and Clarice are most looking forward to at the cinema in the future.
And so out of things that are coming out, I'm going to be able to get to see this a little bit earlier, I guess, because it's at the London Film Festival. So before it's, you know, general release. But I am so excited about Titane, directed by Julia Ducournau, because I was a little bit obsessed with Raw when it came out. I think it was such a like new, fresh, and also just viscerally intense take on the cannibalism movie. And I have heard so many things about Titane, about how wild it is, and I've been trying hard not to be spoiled by it because I just want to go in with fresh eyes, but it just sounds great.
The film I'm looking forward to, I don't even know when it's going to be coming out, but it's had its premiere at Venice and at Toronto Film Festival. It's Official Competition, which is a comedy from Argentinian filmmakers Gaston Duprat and Mariano Con. And it stars Antonio Banderas, Penelope Cruz and Oscar Martinez. And it's basically about, you know, actors showing their film at... you know, at a film festival, Official Competition, as it's in the name. Hopefully it'll do exactly the same as Tin. And I just really hope it's going to be, I mean, just from the images of Penelope Cruz in this like massive ginger curly wig, which apparently she said she wanted to look like Alma Harrell, the Israeli filmmaker who did Honey Boy. Apparently that was her inspo. So that's like, oh my God, love this for Penelope. But yeah, if it's anything like Christopher Guest's For Your Consideration, which is just another perfect mockumentary commentary from him, I'm just going to be super into it. So I'm very intrigued and that's what I'm most looking forward to. So yeah, we are the co-host along with Iman Warman of the Fade to Black podcast, which we you can find us on pretty much all podcast platforms talking weekly film reviews and hot takes. Our episodes go out on a Sunday. It's a really good natter. We have lots of fun.
It's like this, but there's a third person.
Yeah,
just imagine that.
Who we constantly kind of mock a little bit and also make him uncomfortable by saying women's issues sort of things. We love you, Iman. But you can find us, you can find us on Spotify, iTunes, but individually you can find us. I'm at Hannah Flint, H-A-N-N-A, on Twitter, and at Hannah Renes Flint on Instagram.
And I'm at Clarice Liu on Twitter or at Clarice Lockery on Instagram.
And there we go. That's October at the Movies. This is quite exciting because it really is a sign of what's to come in November, December and January and beyond. There are so many major films, not just sort of major in scale and the amount of money they cost to make, but, you know, major films in terms of what's going to be the big film for the award season, which we're about to go into. Who's going to win an Oscar? Who's going to win a BAFTA? This is when those films are being released. So it is, it's always fun. I love trying to watch everything now so I can have an opinion, so I can guess who might take home the big awards next year. But yeah, we are very much in Oscar season, very much in BAFTA qualifying season. So lots of incredible films out. A good time to go to the movies, really. So we will be back in November to cover some of those films with two more guest critics. We may also drop a couple of specials, so do subscribe to the podcast. And yeah, I think it's in the diary. We're going to be talking to Edgar Wright about Last Night in Soho, which will come out as a special episode at the end of the month. So check back for that. And do check out our interview with Kari Joji Fukunaga, which is the episode just before this in the pod feed. Well, that's me plugging. I've been Sam Clements. As always, if you want to see what's on at your local picture house, do head to picturehouses.com. You can also tweet us, Facebook us, Instagram us at picturehouses, just at picturehouses, on your social media platform of choice. We'll be there and we love hearing from you. Speaking of hearing from you, if you'd like to leave the show a rating on Apple Podcasts, that always helps, or subscribing is also another thing that you can do, which helps other people find the show. And if you can spare 30 seconds or so to write a positive review about the podcast, that would be hugely appreciated. Always love reading your reviews and hearing what you think of the show. We couldn't make the show without Stripped Media. A big thank you to Kobe for producing today's episode. And a huge thank you to Maddie Searle for editing the podcast and giving it a good old polish. Big thank you to you also for listening. Thank you for staying to the end. I think it's definitely a badge of honor to stay to the end of the podcast. So thank you so much. Enjoy the movies. Enjoy going back to the cinema. Let us know what you think of the latest James Bond. Let us know what you think of The French Dispatch. Let us know what you think of Never Gonna Snow Again and Dune. And we'll see you next month.